You're listening to Hooked on Harness.
Esto va a llegar. Rian Wesley, Whiteside, residential ball. Whiteside's coming on. Rian, Whiteside, the outside. Whiteside, left, the little brown chair.
Hello, good listener. Welcome to episode number 19 of Hooked on Harness, our first episode of 2020. We are delighted to be back. I'm delighted to be here with my good friends, Bern Tobin and Adam Keane. How are you both?
I'm pretty good, Adam. I'm a little heftier. I think I put on 7 pounds, but I'm going to be slim and trim before long.
A little holiday season insulation. And Adam, what about you?
I'm doing well. I made it out of the deathbed just before the holidays and back on track.
Yeah, I think everybody had the customary holiday cold up here in Southern Ontario. Glad you could join us for this episode 19. We're going to debut a couple of new segments on this program. But before we get to that, we will do our usual and customary horse updates. We'll talk about a new horse that all three of us have bought into. We will debut a new section called Inside the Program. For those of us who are newer to the sport of harness racing, dissecting some of the analytics that are available in the very back pages of your standard program. It's amazing what you can find for $2 and change when you purchase a program at your local track. We'll also debut another new segment called Following Old Horses, where I know I've talked with both of you about what your approaches are on old horses that you've either been involved in or been a part owner on, and how closely do you follow those horses after you've sold them off.
I just don't want them to win too much.
You want them to be successful, but not too much. Yeah, so we'll get into that, and we'll talk about some examples of that, and then we'll do a very interesting match race update from Century Downs in wonderful Edmonton, Alberta. And we will also break for our customary craft beer review at some point in the middle of all that. So stay tuned. And we're back on Hooked on Harness and to our regular section on horse updates. I took the plunge about a month ago and jumped onto a second horse at thestable.ca. This is Walk on the Moon, an Archangel Trotter.
You are crazy.
For the first time, the two of you were crazy enough to get involved in this with me, along with a friend of mine that I've brought along for the ride, first-time owner, long-time friend of mine. But maybe I'll start with both of you. I know why this horse was on my short list going into the Lexington sale, but what piqued your interest, Bern?
He's a trotter. We haven't owned a trotter with thestable.ca, and the guys do well with trotters. So that was an interesting approach. Also wanted Ontario Sire, because we all like to go to the races. Yep. So it's always good to have an Ontario Sire. By Archangel, who's the sire. I was a big fan of Archangel, big black stallion. I remember watching him setting a world record in the Cashman elimination a few years ago at the Meadowlands, 150 flat. So the guy can go. His son of his first crop this year won the Maple Leaf Trot. So lots of fun things there, and a good-looking colt, and all adds up for me. How about you, Adam?
Yeah, for me, I guess part of it, guys, it was the fear of missing out factor. I didn't want to be the one to not have this partnership go forward. So, but all seriousness, I think I've talked in the past mostly about trotters, so being more of a trotting guy or person, that drew me there. And I think to the day of the open house, I didn't make it in person, but watched the video of this colt training. Looks really good. It's early days, but everything looks pretty positive. So I took the plunge and got permission afterwards.
Mr. Marcella, you had this colt on your list. It all started with you.
I thought I had a good, I spent some time geeking out in the catalog, the Lexington catalog before that sale. Of course, he ended up winning, the half-brother ended up winning that OSS race a week after the auction.
Super fun.
Which probably would have resulted in a different selling price of Walk on the Moon had that happened before the sale at Lexington. But nevertheless, it was still a horse that was already of interest of me, I think the challenge that I had is that unlike Adam here to my left, I've less been into trotters because I don't know that I can handle the anxiety of the breaking of stride and that sort of thing. Just expect to see more of that with a trotter. It hasn't happened yet. at least in terms of the training videos that we've been able to watch and the couple times that I've seen him trot live, he seems to be doing what he should be doing at this stage of his training. So that's a good sign, I think.
Yeah, it's always fun. The mare's five for five. You know, half brother has done nicely. And yep. Speed in the family, that's where you start and see where you finish.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, at this point, expecting more than that. I think we're seeing what we should be seeing for this stage of where he's at in the process. So that's great. I'm going to change gears a little bit, Bern. Back in November, you signed up for what I'll call a project horse in Spare Seed. So why don't you tell me about Spare Seed? I've watched him race twice now since Boxing Day, but we can go into that in a minute. But what attracted you to this horse, and what are you hoping to achieve?
Well, you know, last time on the show, I think I talked about selling Hal and Sammy,
yep,
the pacer we had. And just had some money kicking around, and our trainer came, Tim Chirico, and said, hey, we'd like to get a trotter. So found a trotter, Spare Seed, out at Rideau Carrollton. Four-year-old horse. We just thought we could bring him west to Mohawk, probably improve him a little bit, and have some fun. So we've had some challenges. The guy has, we've had some breaks, and we've been run into a couple of times, and broke strides here and there. But last night we were at the racetrack, and he raced a good clean line, so we're looking forward to the weeks ahead.
Yeah, that's great. And you've got probably one of the best barn names for this horse ever. Why don't you, because I know you're also a fellow Star Trek nerd, so why don't you tell me what the barn name is for this horse?
Well, the horse is called Spare Seed. So, you know, what are you going to call a horse? What are you going to go around and call him Spare? No, that's not going to work. So, you know, so if you go, if you're a Star Trek fan, you will remember the episode Space Seed.
Original Star Trek.
Original, yes, Star, yes, Trek, starring
Ricardo Montalban, yeah, that's good.
Khan Noon Singh, the baddest, meanest intergalactic criminal to ever escape Australia and be set adrift in space, awoken by Will Shatner, Captain Kirk, and wanted to take over the world. So why not call a horse Khan?
Khan.
I mean, again, Spare Seed, Space Seed, we may as well call him Khan and try to take over the condition classes at Mohawk.
When I think Ricardo Montalban, I think, what have you done to my Cordoba in those commercials that he used to do for Chrysler back in the 70s. But no, that's a great little piece of trivia there. I love that. Adam, on your end, odds on Amethyst has been racing fairly consistently since last we got together, early November.
Yeah, fairly consistency and fairly well overall. He's hit the board in about five of his last seven starts. So it's sort of a case of checkers or records. Either he's off and he's kind of finishing back of the pack, or he's up there, if not getting his photo taken in the mix. So that's been really encouraging. This is, as we mentioned before, this is his time of the year. And so far this year, it hasn't been a bit any different.
Yeah, that's great. And I think that just to finish up the horse updates, the other one that we've been following fairly closely is one of the two-year-olds in the stable, and that's Keystone Raven. So that's the pacer, mm-hmm, that we talked about the last time a little bit. And she's basically where we'd expect to see her at this point in time. Saw her just around the Christmas open house that they had over there. That was the last time I watched her.
Pacing along, doing well, doing business.
So that's kind of where we sit right now in terms of horse updates. Bern, you mentioned your new horse, Spare Seed, being racing on Boxing Day. I was there as well. That was the race where he was interfered with and ended up having a bit of a tough drive on that. Or I guess a tough trip. But you've had a number of Boxing Day. It's a bit of a Boxing Day tradition at Mohawk,
I've,
right?
I don't know. I've raced on Boxing Day maybe five or six times. And, you know, it's interesting because it's only one track, basically, racing,
sure,
on Boxing Day. That's Mohawk. And you got to have your horse right. You got to have the class drawn. And I always seem to be racing on Boxing Day. And I think the best story I've ever had, as I say, I have been knocked off stride in the fog, like we did last week.
Oh, that was
fun. That's the other end of the spectrum, right?
And we could not see 200 meters past the starting line. It was an entire, like, soup of fog until they were about 200 meters from finishing. You had no idea what you're watching it on track it, basically, because the whole backstretch was entirely invisible.
Yeah, I mean, I like boxing on, racing on Boxing Day. Cause
it was 6 degrees, right?
Oh, yeah.
It was warm.
Well, it's nice. But I'm always waiting. The most fun I ever had on a Boxing Day is my old horse, Maple Leaf Buddy, had come back from an injury. had the 10 hole and was a long shot. He might have been 12, 15 to 1. I can't remember. But my brother-in-law invited his father-in-law to the racetrack. And, you know, he shows up like 2 minutes to the race. And he's coming up the escalator. And my brother-in-law says, hey, come on. What are you doing? You got to get going here. We got the race. And he says, how much money you got? He said, well, I got $60. He said, well, you going to bet? He said, how much did you bet? He said, bet it all. Anyway, my brother-in-law's father-in-law had been at the race 8 minutes, at the racetrack 8 minutes. Maple Leaf Buddy won from the 10 hole in somewhat dramatic fashion.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He'd been at the racetrack 8 minutes, had his pitcher in the winner's circle, and he had $600 in his pocket.
That's great. That's great.
So, didn't happen this week. Maybe next year.
A little more positive than what we saw this week, this past Boxing Day for sure. So that's good stuff. So we're going to try a new segment this time around called Inside the Program. And this is basically, I've spent a little bit of time nerding out on parts of the program that I don't normally spend a lot of time looking at.
I saw you at the racetrack twice this week, basically taking people under your wing, trying to explain parts of the program.
And that's a scary proposition, given that I'm not that much of an expert at it by a long shot. So trying to explain it to newbies in terms of what they should be looking for. And a question that I really find myself asking to myself and to others is, you know, what is the value of a driver paired up with a certain horse? And if you move towards the back of any program, any of the Woodbine Mohawk programs, you'll see a stat sheet basically that talks about a driver rating system, the UDRS, Universal Driver Rating System. It's a statistic along with a winning percentage that tries to give you some kind of an understanding or an analytical understanding of what is the value of a driver. And not surprisingly, some of the drivers that you see at Mohawk week in, week out, like, I'm not surprised to see a driver like Sylvain Filion right up at the top of that list and with a pretty favorable UDRS. But maybe, Adam, I'll ask you, because I guess for the perspective of somebody who's newer to harness racing, if we're going inside the program and want to understand this a bit better, what is the UDRS, or the Universal Driver Rating System?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's not an average, which I think a lot of people assume the way it's written. It kind of jumps out of the page like an average, but it's a formula based on factoring in the wins, places, and shows. So the way it works is wins are worth 9 points, places are 5, shows are 3, and then you divide that total by 9 and the number of starts. Mm. So I hope I got that algebra
close
right.
Close enough.
So if it's basically weighting wins as more than places and places as more than shows, am I wrong in thinking of it roughly as an equivalent of an on-base plus slugging in baseball, where you get more credit for a home run or a triple than you do a double or a single? And is that kind of roughly how I should think about this?
That's a great analogy. Yep.
I think it's something that I'd never really spent much time looking at, but I think where it starts to break down a little bit for me is, and we were talking about this a little bit earlier, you know, some of these drivers have, you know, over 1,000 races in the span of a year. And looking at some of those top 5 or 6, they're well over 1,400 races a piece. And you contrast that with some of the drivers that may have a much higher winning percentage, but a much smaller number. So you start to ask yourself, is this just falling victim to the small sample size factor? But what would you say about some of those differences, Bern, as you go up and down that list of drivers?
Well, perfect example. You've got Sylvain Filion here at the top, where you 1,700 starts, 260 wins, $5.4 million, UDRS of 2.271. You get a little lower down here, you find Andrew McCarthy, Dexter Dunn, you know, Grand Circuit drivers who travel the Grand Circuit race for big money. Guys won like $3 million in 70 starts, and with UDRSs is 4.27 and 3.59. So it's an interesting statistic, a very good statistic, but it needs some, some context.
Yeah, because if someone like a Dexter Dunn with a UDRS of 0.359, that's really, really good, almost jumps off the page. Andrew McCarthy, 0.427, really, really good. I think one of the highest in this whole column, that's the highest I see on 70 starts. But they're also racing exclusively stakes horses, right? Like, these are the best of the best versus kind of just what shows up that week, right? Am I wrong in thinking of it that way?
Yeah.
I don't know how to correct for the horse.
Well, exactly. A driver...
Or the horses, so, if you will.
There's things to think about. Good drivers are good drivers. There are better drivers than... Some drivers are better than others. But a lot of what makes a driver good is the horses they're driving. So, for example, someone like Sylvain Filion or Louis-Philippe Roy at the top of the driver standings, they're good drivers and they tend to get good horses. So the good trainers with good horses want the good drivers. So it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Sure.
You know, you've got skill and you get, you know, good talent to drive.
Yeah.
a guy like Andrew McCarthy and Dexter Dunn, they come to town with high-powered trainers, whether it's Tony Alagna or Chris Ryder with horses, and they're driving in big money. So they're going to have big numbers as well. So it's almost two different things you got to think about. And the other thing I would think about is, you know, Sylvain Filion, you know, races in Grand Circuit races in high money races, but a lot of the times you're racing for $17,000 on a Tuesday night.
Yeah.
And that's a different skill set as well, you know, compared to racing for $500,000. So a lot of things when it comes to looking at driver statistics, look at the statistics, but you almost got to look at the race. What type of horse are you racing?
Who are you racing against?
And who's your trainer?
Yeah.
Do you have a powerful trainer who's given you good horses? It's a good stat, but it needs some context.
Yeah, I was going to say there too, the UTRS, so the trainer rating, to me, is probably a more valuable stat, generally speaking, if you're picking up the program for Monday.
Same formula, but for trainers, right?
Exactly. Same formula, but for trainers. And the one other thing that's interesting, just when we're looking at the top drivers back for a second, relatively small separation in terms of these rating scores in the top 10. So on those any given Tuesday $17,000 condition race, there's not a really big spread in terms of the at least that measure of a driver's potential skill.
I think from the number one down to maybe the number nine or 10, you're talking about 0.271 versus 0.26 or 0.20. So you're right. They're pretty tight. Would either of you use that so let's talk about it on the training side of things. Why do you think that's more predictive or more value than looking at it even from a driver perspective?
Well, I mean, like, I think it's kind of similar, right? I mean, good trainers usually have good horses, usually have them ready, have them classified properly. They're there. They know how to make money. So that's part of it. And then you put the driver on the horse in that situation, and the driver has an opportunity to use his skill, make good decisions, and have a higher percentage of winning. So I look first at the trainer, then the driver, and both ways. And I think if you look at it, both of them, you got a better chance of, you know, making a good decision with your betting dollar.
So an interesting question that I find myself asking in my own head is, you know, the combination of the trainer with the driver with the horse. Mm-hmm. Now you've got at least, it's a single horse athlete, but you have it paired up with a driver that's been brought along a certain way using a certain type of training approach. So there's a lot of variables within that are sometimes very hard to tease apart. I mean, at the end of the day, the favorites are the favorites, because people smarter than I am kind of have a sense of who's going to end up hitting the ticket, winning, placing, or showing within that race. And more often than not, that holds true. But you have this other added variability that, at least in my eyes, is very hard to piece apart. But it's interesting, nevertheless.
Yeah, and to me, I guess I'm from the mentality that the sort of the trainer rating represents the horse. And to me, the horse is 95% plus of the factor of who might win. And that driver piece is you're kind of arguing around the margins, relatively small factor.
That's probably true. Yeah, that's.
I mean, the only final point I'd make is, you know, if you're looking at Woodbine Mohawk, I mean, like, you've got some real good drivers here, you know, Filion, Wah, Bob McClure, on and on and on. Any of these guys can get the job done at that level anytime. Yeah. And, you know, you really got to look at the horse, look at the trainer. And I think you put any of those guys in the right situation, they're going to do a good job. I think the demarcation point for me is when you're racing for big money. And that's when Andrew McCarthy and, you know, all these guys come
hired
to town.
Hired guns for the
Breeders' Crown. Because it's a different, anybody will tell you, it's a lot different pulling the right line when you're going for $500,000 or $1 million and you're racing for $17,000 on a Tuesday night. You've got to earn your spurs on the Grand Circuit. And I think a lot of these guys have done it. You know, Doug McNair ride drives there and on and on and on. Jody Jameson's won a lot of big races over the years. That's the measure of the driver. And the guys who can do that most consistently at the high level are the best drivers. But any of these guys can get the job done on the right horse on a Tuesday night.
So this has turned a little bit into the episode of new segments. So in addition to inside the program, we're also going to try something new. I've had a number of conversations with both of you gentlemen around your old horses, horses that you've owned in the past that have gone on to race either in other jurisdictions or for different barns and other trainers. I've always been fascinated by this. I haven't necessarily had the bandwidth or time to keep a close handle on what's happened with Sunshine Inn and Art Seeker, horses that I've owned in the past. Certainly not because of lack of interest, but just lack of time. And where do you go to find this information? Adam, you've talked to me about the fact that you don't often follow what happens to your past horses, right?
Yeah, it's weird. Even people that I've owned horses with, I think of somebody that was on one of our early programs, Chuck, right? Like Chuck, horses that we've owned pieces of, he knows what they're up to. He knows what they had for lunch yesterday. I'm the opposite. Kind of once they're out of sight, out of mind, you hope they do well. You hope the horse goes on to have a good rest of their career, but I just, whether it's the time or what it is, it just isn't something I've done.
And it's probably a little bit of the time and just like the resourcing to go and actually find that information or the wherewithal to go ahead and do it. On the other end of that spectrum is Byrne, who you pretty much can, along the lines of what Chuck does, go and say what the horse had for lunch yesterday, because you certainly follow your past horses fairly closely.
Yeah, I just can't get rid of them there, Adam. That's my problem. Last night, I was watching Hal and Sammy. You remember the horse we talked about? I had for a long time. Sold, and Hal...
Sold just in November.
Yeah,
like
just in November, and Hal was racing down in Miami Valley Racetrack in Ohio, and Sammy was Sammy, did the same thing. Sat around, raced along in fifth, fell asleep a little bit, woke up at the end, finished second, should have finished first. Same story. Yeah. He played out for us many, many times, so... You know, and then about a half hour later, I watched Entranced, who was the trotter I owned with Gareth Gordon a number of years ago. He's still going down in Northfield Park. Yeah, so it's fun. It's fun to watch them. But I'm like you, Adam. You know, you want the horses to do well.
But not too well.
And you sold them. And, you know, if they're any good, you got decent money for them. So, you know, you want the horse to do well. But, you know, I don't know. It's, I've had some strange situations over the years. I bought a horse called Get Around Town. Oh.
A while ago, right?
This is 8 or 9 years ago now. And we raced him as a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old. And he was the OSS, Ontario Sired. Raced okay. Actually won his first two starts. And then we were all excited. Then he just sort of, you know, just got petered out and just becoming a so-so horse.
Like injuries or what?
Always had sore feet and, you know, just never seemed to finish a mile. We always thought, hey, you know, if he could ever... And we just gave up on him at the end of his 3-year-old season. Yeah. Sold him. And we never thought he'd amount to much. That was 6 years ago and 240 starts later.
Holy cow.
I never thought he'd be sound, but he's raced 40 times a year for every year for 6 years. And I mean... Bloody thing turned out to be a war horse.
Is that just a case of a horse needing time to mature? I mean, you talk about, we've talked in the past on past episodes about horses not really racing effectively as 2-year-olds or maybe even 3-year-olds and really taking a little bit longer to really get going and establish themselves.
Yeah. You know, you got to make decisions on horses. You know, are they going to be good? And if you're battling sore feet or whatever, you make a decision. And who knows? A year later... They mature, you know, they sound up on their feet. And this guy, as I say, he's raced 240 times. And he's made $400,000 now. You know, not a great horse. You know, in 6 years, you know, he's paid the bills. You know, you're not going to get rich. But he's won a lot of races and been a real good horse. And I cheer for him all the time. You know, and... you know,
where is he racing now?
He is racing down in Ohio. So I think they just moved over to Northfield and Miami Valley. So may I hook up with Hal and Sammy. I don't know who I'll cheer on. But I've had a lot of fun over the years. I mean, like we sold a horse called Keystone Swagger. Had Tim Tietrich race him for us. Finished second to Break the Bank K in, I'm going to say the Champlain, but I could be wrong. But a real nice horse, sold him. And I watched him win about 2 years later. set the track record in Minnesota at Running Acres.
Holy Jesus.
And he had it for 3 days and someone broke it. It's just the way it goes. And I always keep an eye on one of my favorite horses, Quin Man. Now, Quin Man was a stud. He wasn't the greatest horse. He was a nice little horse. Took America 150. We sold him to Ronnie Burke. Ronnie raced him a few years, and he retired. And now he's a stud in Indiana. And he's got 4 yearlings.
First year, first crop.
For sale this year. And I don't know, boys. I have to keep an eye on him. I might have to buy me a horse.
That's good. Okay, so our first craft beer review of 2020 had to do it a little bit different this time, guys, because I was not organized enough here on a Sunday evening.
Shame
as we're
you.
Recording this after 2 weeks of being away from work. I was not organized to actually go out and buy 3 of the same beer that is anything other than a Heineken or a Stella, which is more or less almost entirely what is in my cold room right now. But we had a bunch of friends over a couple days ago, good friends of ours. Actually, this does tie back to horse racing. So Marco and Rob, some very good friends of mine who are involved in some of these new yearlings that we've purchased, as well as Anthony, they came over with their spouses, kids. We had, I think, 30 people in the house, and they brought beers. Well, Marco brought a bunch of craft beers with him. So this is one of the owners who is on Keystone Raven. So he brought one of these beers over, and that is the beer that I have split 3 ways in these glasses. It is not, so remember, just for the sake of any of our new listeners, we do a win, place, or show. Usually this segment starts with us opening the cans, but because there was only one can, I poured it into 3. So we got here, we're looking at it. Adam, why don't you describe what you're looking at here in the glass?
I don't know what I'm... I guess it's murky. Yeah, I was trying to think of the scientific word, like kind of almost opaque. I haven't tasted it yet, but my nose has got a whiff. Interesting.
Interesting. Bern, what is your keen sense?
Well, it's a cloudy sense. I'll say that. It's got a... it's a lot of hops in this thing, Dave.
Why don't you gentlemen go and have a taste
of that?
That's
a lot of hops. Yeah.
I know this is not, Bern, what you typically go for.
I can smell a hop. I can smell a hop.
I feel like we say that every time. It's not what Bern typically goes for, but he tends to like this stuff.
It's got a lemony, citrusy flavor here as well.
Rather citrusy, yeah.
And it's a meaty beer. I'm not going to drink a lot of this stuff, but I like it. I think that the citrus levels out the hops, so it neutralizes me.
So you're going with a win, place, or show on that, Bern?
One more sip.
Those of you listening at home can either drink along with something else or just listen to the 3 of us doing this, which is seems about right. Adam, what do you...
It's crisp. Kind of reminds me, I mean, I know it's not a craft, but kind of Hoegaarden-y.
Sure.
A little ode to that. Yeah. I'm going to give it a place. Here we are in January. I could picture myself out on a patio in May, sipping one of these guys.
Yeah, it's a place for me as well. I got a little bit, I guess, skewed in the sense that I knew the style of beer that it was before I tasted it. But I think it's a pretty good execution on that style of beer, which I'll reveal in a minute. What about you, Bern?
Well, I'm going to try something a little different. It's not going to be a win, place, and show. It's going to be a 20-cent Triactor box. How about that?
Oh, my God.
And the reasons here
the
is,
exotics.
You know, I don't know if this is a win, a place, or a show. But if I drink enough of it, I might like it. And if it all comes in together, I'm going to cash the Triactor.
I love it. So here's what this is. And it's coming out of a brewery that we actually know well. Right from Guelph, Ontario. This is a Wellington. Have we done a Wellington beer before? I don't think we have. So this was, Marco brought this over a couple days ago. It's the Upside IPA. And I know you're generally... do you usually go for IPAs?
Typically, there's a lot of hoppy.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. But this is the Upside IPA, described as hazy, juicy, and tropical. There you go. 6.8% alcohol, strong beer. What else to say here? Upside is exploding with juicy grapefruit, peach, and tropical hop flavors. This New England-style IPA has a hazy appearance, soft mouthfeel, and balanced bitterness. which allows the vibrant dry hop flavors to shine.
Oh, well,
I enjoy
this. I'll write that myself.
This is that sounds like ad copy if I ever heard it. But no, very very tasty beer. I'm I don't normally go for IPAs myself, and that's why I say if there's seven beers on a selector menu, the IPA will probably be the last thing that I'll pick. But it's still a place for me because I think that's actually a pretty good one.
I agree.
Nice job, gentlemen.
Good, job. Good stuff.
Cheers.
So an aspect of the sport that we don't talk about very often on this podcast is the wagering or gambling aspect of horse racing. But obviously, guys, it's an important part of the overall health of the industry and the health of harness racing and horse racing in general. Some data that just came out very recently is some of the handle data around 2019. And this was just published recently, I believe, on Standard Bred Canada. And Bern, why don't you tell us a little bit, for the sake of people who are newer to the sport, what does this all mean in terms of the handle and what were the trends that we saw in 2019?
Well, overall, I think, you know, we're seeing a positive trend. The numbers are pretty simple. The overall bet on harness racing across the country, on Canadian racing, was up about 9% to, I think, about $491 million across Canadian racing, which is awesome. And what's also interesting is actually they have per wager on per race. So that was actually up 11%, which is probably a more interesting statistic because, you know, it takes out that variable whether you had more races and more racing cards. It's just, you know, how much actually you went in and bet on an individual race. These numbers that I'm speaking of specifically are Mohawk and Woodbine. And those guys are the big drivers. You know, about maybe 75% of all the betting in Canada is done on Mohawk Woodbine product.
And just to ask a totally naive question, so I'm assuming that that's all wagering on those races, so that includes off-track wagering?
Yeah, so that they actually split it down. So if you look at the, they call it foreign wagering, so any money bet outside of Canada on Canadian product, that's actually up 15% to $243 million at Woodbine with what they call home market area, so local in Canada money, around flat at $88 million. So they actually separate the two. So you can see a nice jump from overseas.
Yeah, and I guess just asking it as a total newbie, silly question, that's important because I'm assuming that has some bearing on ultimate purses, or I guess the viability of the sport in general across Canada, or is it as straightforward as that?
Well, exactly. I mean, like, this sport, we talk about it a lot about, you know, getting new owners and buying shares and horses, and our experience is really the love of harness racing and getting going to the racetrack. We bet on our horses as well. But the viability of this industry, you've got to have people betting on the product.
Yeah.
And having confidence in the product and growing the bet. And, you know, the takeout, that's what the racetracks run on. And that helps fuel the purses and obviously those type of things. So we've got to have that grow for the industry to be sustainable.
Yeah, and obviously we're here in Ontario, so Ontario Lottery Gaming, OLG, they have other products in terms of sports wagering as well, things like Proline, that sort of thing. But I think that's overall a positive trend for the sector and for the industry in Canada, if that's moving in the right direction. In addition to the ownership angle, there's the wagering angle that obviously is important, I would think. So, good.
Yeah, for sure. And a final shout-out, I mean, we talk about Woodbine and Mohawk, the big track, right? Doing well and growing, but I just want to do a nice shout out to the folks at Western Fair, the Raceway in London.
London, Ontario.
Yeah. Set a handle record New Year's Eve, $795,000 bet on a 10-race card. Outstanding work, great work. Greg Blanchard, Greg Gangle, and Sugar Doyle, those guys doing some great work out there.
Have they always done that, New Year's Eve racing at Western Fair, or is that a new thing?
Yeah, they run a lot of cards during the holidays, and it's great for them.
That's great.
Sometimes the other racetracks aren't as active, and they get to really showcase their product, and as you say, people show up.
So we are going to sign off with some audio from a wonderful match race that happened just before Christmas at Century Downs, which is a one of the newer tracks, certainly the newest track in Canada, but a year old in wonderful Edmonton, Alberta. So shout out to our harness racing listeners out in Alberta. I'm in Alberta and in Edmonton probably three or four times a year for work. I've not yet had a chance, though, to actually go see this track since it's opened. It's practically adjacent to the airport,
yeah,
right?
Like
it's
close.
It's right next door almost. So I really want to go out there to see this, but they did something pretty goofy and entertaining just before Christmas.
Yeah, they put together this really neat video, The Race to Save Christmas, Santa Claus versus the Grinch. And great shout out to Ken G, the track announcer, who called an awesome drive.
It was highly entertaining.
Yeah, and the guys in the sulky, forgive me, I don't know who they were, but you know.
Wait, the Grinch and Santa?
Oh yeah, the Grinch and Santa. Santa was sort of like really reserved and didn't move a muscle, but the Grinch was showboating, highlining on the front end, thought he had it won, and Santa hauled him down. It was great. It was awesome.
Dare I say, the Grinch was highly theatrical, and it was amazing. Yeah. It was certainly fun to watch. So we'll end on that.
Yeah, 15,000 views just came out before Christmas. Big shout out to those guys. We need more of that.
Yeah, that's great. So listen, we'll sign off with that. In the meantime, don't forget to follow us on Twitter, to follow us on Facebook. And we really do appreciate you hanging with us and listening. You can also reach us on hookthatharness@gmail.com if you want to get in touch via old-fashioned email. But thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
The race to save Christmas, here they come. They're off and pacing. From the inside, the Grinch driving out for the lead. Now in second, taking back slightly, is Santa and Rudolph. As they head into the first turn, it is the Grinch in front, following closely and not getting behind too far. Well, now actually dropping back a length or two is Santa. It is the Grinch leading by a half a length. It's the Grinch very confident, hasn't even looked back to challenge yet. Now looking over the Grinch's shoulder, here comes Santa. Santa making a big move down the backside, and now coming up to even terms with Rudolph and Max. They've reached the half marker, the North Pole, I would guess, in 106-2. So now they're playing possum as Santa and Rudolph now back off. And the Grinch and Max now start to open up. Look at the showboating by the Grinch. Picking up those lines and mocking Santa. As the Grinch rounds the far turn, he's pretty self-absorbed on the front end. Santa content to sit second, not making a move yet. They round the turn and they reach for the three quarters. They reach that marker in 139-2, and the race is on. The Grinch thinks he's got it. Win leads by two. Here comes Santa stepping on the gas and asking Rudolph for more. Santa says, dash, dash away, and now makes up to even terms with the Grinch. It's Santa now drawing up alongside. Grinch has no idea what's happened as they drive down the stretch. It's Santa by a neck with Rudolph coming down to the wire. Santa, ho, ho, holds on for the win. Christmas is saved at Century Mile.